This is a Triple J podcast.
Hey, you're listening to Science with Dr. Carl. Sam Lane with you here, filled in for Lucy this week, had Zoe Keane alongside me, also filling in for Dr. Carl. We covered a lot of fun topics, including Zoe's echidna year, whether grey hair grows differently to brown hair, and the habits of mud crabs. Let's jump straight into it. It's time for science. Usually with Dr. Carl, but today we have Zoe Keane on the line. Hello, Zoe. How are you? Friend of the pod.
Hello. Friend of the pod, but first time meeting you, which is super exciting.
Yes, this is my first time doing science. I'm very, very excited. I've been trying to get my skills up, read about my science in preparation. But you are a seasoned science communicator. Do you want to tell the people, in case they don't know who you are, what your background is?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a science writer and communicator and journalist. So I've worked across a whole bunch of different SciComm lands. Like there's the SciComm or the science journalism where you're really kind of interrogating science with that more critical lens. And I've done that at places like the ABC. So I worked with the science unit in 2019 and I work down here in Lutruwita, Tasmania for the ABC now. And my book is a piece of science journalism. So I wrote a book called Why We Like This, which is about life's big questions through an evolutionary lens. So why do we have sex? Why do we sleep? Why do we care for each other and have consciousness and drink alcohol? All these types of things through an evolutionary question, looking at the evolutionary science behind that. So kind of weighing up different people's ideas. But I also love science communication, and that's more the, all right, how do we get these scientific ideas out to people and empower people to understand the world better through science? Because science is just actually understanding the world around you, and that's the fun bit. So
I agree, and I think I've come back to science. My science background is a 34 in my physics midterm in year 10, but since then I've been reading a lot of science books about rivers, about nature, as I've been getting into that. So I love that. But we should address the elephant in the room. Dr. Carl is off on a science-related mission this week. So he is actually wrapping up at UCID after 30 years. So if you want to get your Dr. Carl fix, you can head along. There's some tickets for an event called Dr. Carl's Three Decades of Greatest Hits. He has so much knowledge over those three decades, and you can go see him live. It's free. You just need to, you know, RSVP. Head to Dr. Carl's socials to grab the details. But I think we should start off with some questions. First up, we've got Susie in Barara Heights. Hey, Susie, how are you?
Hey, doctors, I'm good. How are you?
Fabulous. What's your question?
It's actually a question my sister Mima has been burning to ask you for ages. It's about the sun. She wants to know if you could get close enough to the surface of the sun and you could hear what it sounded like. Would it sound like a burning fire or maybe the roar of an erupting volcano?
Oh, I love that question, Dr. Susie and Dr. Susie's sister. Scientists have actually done this. There is only so close that you can get to the sun before, you know, you incinerate and things go very bad, and it doesn't matter what you heard, you can't tell anyone about it. But researchers have got close-ish to the sun and made recordings about that. And there's a whole, you know, tranche of people who are just totally focused on researching the sun, what it looks like, what it sounds like. And the answer is it's kind of like, yeah, that swooshy kind of like staticky sound. You can Google it. It's online on YouTube. You can hear it. And the thing I like about it is it's so dynamic, because when we look at the sun, it looks like don't look at the sun with your eyes, but when we observe the sun subtly through our life, it kind of always looks the same. It's just this ball hanging up in the sky. But it is this wildly dynamic thing with, you know, explosions happening. So you mentioned the sound of a volcano. Well, you are going to get these times where the sound is more extreme because it's doing different extreme things. And while the Artemis II astronauts have been up in space, it's been very active, actually. And we know when it's active because we get these incredible auroras down here on Earth. And so it would sound different, for what it's happening. But yeah, kind of like staticky whooshing type of sound, like maybe putting your head underwater and moving your arms around a bit.
My headcanon is that the sun is saying hello to the astronauts up there. It's like frantically waving its arms. That's what it's doing.
It's like, I just want to say hello.
Hey,
I know,
guys.
I'm putting more radiation at you than I would normally spew out, but it's just my way of saying g'day.
Thanks so much for your question, Susie. I hope you relay that to Mira, Dr. Mira, of course.
Yeah, relay that to Dr. Mira. And yeah, it's on YouTube, so you can listen. But the closer you got, the louder it would be. And yeah, Yeah, a bit too hot.
Thanks so much,
Thanks
Susie.
Thanks so much.
And then we have a question from Courtney in Nam, Melbourne. Courtney, hello.
Hi, doctors. How are you going?
Going well, Courtney. What is your question today?
I was wondering, why does it feel so good to scratch your eyes when you're tired?
Ooh, this is a good one, Dr. Courtney. And I have observed this in myself, but also if you spend time around little kids, they will start scratching their eyes. And that's kind of one of the first signs, other than, you know, behavioural things, like having a tantrum or something, to kind of clue you into the fact that they're really tired. And so that's what got me researching this a little while ago. And your eyes are lubricated all the time by tears, right? So we cry when we're sad or emotional, but we also have this, you know, just constant wetness coming out of our eyes, our basal tears. And what's controlling our basal tears is hormones throughout the day. And at the start of the day, we have, you know, a nice kind of tranche of hormones helping us have nice lubricated eyes for the entire, you know, to get us through the day. And so our eyes can move about and feel comfortable. But as those hormones drift off through the day, our eyes aren't getting that signal to create more basal tears. And so it can get itchy and uncomfortable. And that's why your eyes feel yucky when you're tired. And it can be even worse if you add things to it. So if you go on a flight and the air is really dry and then you're really drying out and you really need to rub your eyes. So when you rub your eyes, that actually is a different way to signal your body to create those basal tears. So it actually helps your eyes re-lubricate. So you've got throughout the day this system of your hormones dropping off and your eyes getting drier, and you can kind of hack that system by rubbing it. But then there's also an emotional kind of aspect to that. You might rub your eyes and they feel better because they're not dry anymore, but you might also feel calmer and kind of a little bit more regulated and happy when you're getting tired. And that is because rubbing your eyes and putting just a little bit of deep pressure on your eyes has a whole lot of physiological changes all through your body. So your heart rate will slow down and you get calmer. So it's a way of calming yourself down. So it's a self-soothing mechanism and also a way of getting your tears going. So that's why it feels good on those two levels. It is something you have to be careful. If you're too much of an eye rubber or you're rubbing your eyes too hard, then you can cause physical damage. With your, you know, you can smoosh the shape of your corneas and really, cause a lot of damage. But that soft, gentle eye rubbing, it has those two functions. And that's why when you maybe, if you go to a salon and they put cucumber on your eye or something like that, it's just giving you that little bit of pressure and that'll help calm you down and helps that calming experience.
Thanks for your question, amazing. Courtney.
Thank you so much.
So this is my first science hour, and so I thought I should allow myself a little treat to ask you a science question because one that's been burning at me for a little while. So I am a very amateur bird watcher. I like going outside with my binoculars and my bird guide and having a look. And I watched a documentary recently called Listers, which was about two brothers who have no idea about bird watching trying to do what's called a big year in the US, where you try and see as many birds as you can in one year. And they ran into a science ethical quandary.
Yes.
So there is a debate in the bird watching community about the use of bird song and bird calls to lure out birds, because essentially what I think they're doing is like saying, hey, what's up? I'm a cute single bird in your area. And
yeah.
Then the birds get tricked. But there's ethics about whether that's okay. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. First of all, you have waded or flapped yourself into a potentially controversial world, because birders, there are a lot of controversies in the birding world. I love bird watching, but I wouldn't consider myself a birder. And there are a few things to consider here. So if you're putting some speakers out into the forest or the desert or wherever you're looking for your birds and essentially putting this call out that's saying, hey, I'm a sexy bird, or I'm a threat to you, come and fight me, whatever the call you're putting out there is, you can be confusing birds and, you know, messing with their feelings, and no one likes to be, you know, have their heart messed with in that way. But also a lot of the birds that people might be looking for in this particular way, they haven't found through just their binoculars, because they are rare and hard to find. And if they're rare and hard to find, that might be because they're under a whole lot of environmental pressure. So we've learnt recently that our beautiful superb fairy wrens here in Australia, even though we see them around a lot, could be extinct in a few decades because they rely on eating insects. And if you think about the life of an insect-eating bird, our insects are under pressure themselves and there are fewer and fewer insects around. And if you're this tiny bird with a really high metabolism, you need to eat a lot to stay alive. And if you're distracting these birds from, you know, what they need to be doing to have a healthy life and eat, say, insects when there's fewer and fewer of them around, you could be causing them direct harm in that way. So animals' life can be, yeah, sometimes easy and chill, depending on where you are, but it can be very tough and you don't want to be distracting. So that would be my concern. If it was a place where you knew the population was really healthy and happy and it was something that the ecologists in that region gave the okay to, fine. Go for it. But I think it's very site specific. But I did want to give a shout out. I can't remember the name of the content creator, but there's a content creator in WA who's doing a thing called a little big year. So a big year is when you try and find as many birds as you can in that year. But you need to be able to take often a whole year off. You need to travel a whole lot. You might be traveling around the world or you might be traveling around Australia and that can be super expensive. So this content creator is doing in their local government district a little big year just in the LGA. And I'm loving it because I can't remember their name or their pronouns, but this person who seems very cool is teaching us so many things about, you know, swans and all these everyday birds that you see that you might not take notice of. And so if you're into the idea of a big year, I'd definitely try and find them on social media and follow them because it's really cool.
A medium year, even.
A medium year. Just have a little medium year.
Have a medium year. We've got a question from Jake from Bayview. Hey, Jake.
Hi. I was wondering, so me and my brother, we can, like, move our eyes back and forth really fast at, like, 30 times a second.
Whoa.
And no one else we know can. I was wondering why this is.
So is that, your eyes going sideways or up and down?
Sideways.
Ooh, okay. That's a party trick. That's a cool one. It's called a nystagmus. And it's just this trick that some people can do. You know how some people can wiggle their ears? And other people can't. I can't wiggle my ears, but I've met people who can just look at you dead in the eye and wiggle their ears. It's just something people can do and it tends to run in families. And because it tends to run in families, I'd suggest that it's a genetic thing. So you just have a cool party trick. It's if you're going to see the eye doctor, worth letting them know, telling them about it in case something's coming up, but you probably just have a cool, fun trick.
Jake, yeah. Do you have anyone else in your family who can do that?
No, just me and my brother.
Special. Ooh, you're the chosen
so interesting.
Ones. Great party trick.
Yeah, I wonder if your parents could but haven't, or maybe, I don't know how this is genetically regulated, but sometimes you need to get, you know, two sets of genes and maybe you got genes from both of your parents. Yeah, sometimes two parents without red hair can have a red-headed kid.
Recessive maybe, alleles, I remember that.
Exactly. Maybe it's recessive alleles and maybe they both handed that down to you and that just through chance you and your brother can both do it. That's so cool.
Thanks so much for your question, Jake. Zoe, I hear you have a special interest of your own. I think because we're getting a bit silly this week, it's like the substitute teachers are in town. I hear you have a special science interest you want to tell the people about.
Oh, well, I've got many special interests, but yes. This year has been my echidna year. It's been my little big year for echidnas. It's been weird. I cannot go anywhere without seeing echidnas. I live in Hobart, and so I go for bushwalks and this type of thing and see echidnas, but I've also just been seeing them on the street in the suburbs. I saw one walking up someone's stairs recently. I just heard this kind of weird rattling sound and it was the echidna spines rattling on the concrete. And echidnas, like, they're kind of okay climbers. It was just going up these stairs. I've seen them, in two or three suburbs just rocking about. And so when you see an animal a lot, you start researching them. And so I've been researching all these different things about echidnas and learning about their evolution and, you know, their strange penises and all sorts of things about them. If people have echidna questions, like, now is the time.
Sorry, elephant in the room, or should I say echidna in the room? Strange what nows?
Oh, yeah. So echidnas, I mean, lots of Australian animals have strange
appendages.
Yeah, you know, so, like, kangaroos have two kind of three vaginas and that's just part of the course. So we're in the land of weird junk. But echidna penises look super alien. They're kind of like they have a shaft, as a penis often does, but then it looks like they've got four suckers on the end of their shaft. So instead of a head, it's like, imagine on an octopus's arm, it's got those suckers, right? They kind of have these like little suckers there. So really wacky, wacky down there.
It's and a crazy it's not, year. A spiky year is what you could
spiky,
call it.
It's a spiky year. So yeah, yeah, they've got interesting other things about them. Yeah, they don't have a pouch all the time, but they create a pouch to carry their eggs around in.
Echidnas make do.
Yeah, echidnas make do. They're pretty cool. They can live for decades. They're smart. Amazing
and they
animals.
Can climb stairs in Hobart. We've been talking about echidnas, Zoe. I feel like the people have to know, what is another cute echidna sighting you've had?
Well, last week I was on a kayaking trip in southeast Tasmania on the Tasman Peninsula, and I went to go and check out the break where Shipston's Bluff is. So this is like one of the best like scary wave surfing places in Australia. And there's a place where you can be up on this really high cliff and look out over shippies and watch the surfers. The surf wasn't going off, but when we got there, right at the lookout place, there was a young, like a juvenile, quite small, cute echidna with the most epic view. And echidnas, if you're chilled, they'll usually chill out. So I just sat down and it walked right past me, almost touched my leg, and then started feeding right next to me. And I could see its little kind of muscles working as its tongue went in and out. So their scientific name is tachyglossus, and that means fast tongue. So they've got this really fast, sticky tongue that just goes in and out really quickly. And I could see the muscles working to make the tongue go in and out really quickly as it was getting into this ant colony that was right next to me. It was so good.
Oh, my God. You live a very blessed life. We have some more questions on the line. Ben from Me and Jim Brisbane, hello.
How you doing?
Very good, Ben. What's your question?
It's a little odd. My question was around instinct and, I guess, evolutionary biology.
Ooh, I love
it. I've had this scenario in my head for a long time, mainly around the idea of what do animals' instincts tell them about their behavior and whether they know what they're doing or why. And I guess my best examples are things like, does a caterpillar know that it's going to become a butterfly or why it's building a cocoon? Does a praying mantis know it's going to bite the head off? Does the partner know it's going to get its head bitten off? What do, like, is there a way that you, people can, I suppose, measure that sort of conscious awareness or constant conscious drive that animals have for some of these pretty unusual behaviors?
That is such an incredible question. Thank you. There's two kind of parts to it there. I'm going to start by busting a myth and then I'll get into the question. So there is a myth around specifically praying mantises that the females will always decapitate the males and eat them after sex. And this tends to happen when they're stressed out. So it tends to happen more in captivity and less out in the world. But that kind of it's got a name for it. It's something cannibalism. There's a really wonderful scientist, Dr. Anastasia, who studies this kind of stuff in Australia. But it happens with spiders a lot. So does the male spider know that he's going to be eaten? And then are they making conscious decisions? So firstly, the question of animal consciousness is super kind of controversial. And there's researchers who think that there is a huge amount of consciousness in the world, and animals have, real insight into who they are and what they're feeling. And then other researchers think, nah, you pretty much have to be a human or maybe a dolphin to be conscious. I tend to think that consciousness starts in, smaller and we say less complicated, but maybe not less complicated animals. That's just where I tend to guess. It's a guess. But in terms of do they know what's going to happen to them, something that is really great is watching, there's a David Attenborough documentary, Life in the Undergrowth, that has a lot of invertebrate stuff. And you see all these spiders going up to the female and the kind of nervousness and how they really take their time. And they're obviously really scared of getting to her. So there's obviously something built in there. They kind of know things could go wrong. But whether they're making the conscious choice, I need to have babies and offspring to then, have progeny in the future and I will take this risk. I think they probably, when you're talking about something like a spider, don't know. I think there's probably that's just an instinct-driven thing. That would be where I would create my hypothesis. If I was asking a scientific question, that would be my null hypothesis, what I thought was happening. But then when you get to a more complicated animal or an animal that's closer to us, something like does a bonobo understand the idea of paternity? Would like a father know its own son? Now that is an interesting question and something that I'm not sure we can answer. So philosophical can of worms, don't know, great question, but also science doesn't know.
Thanks so much for your question, Ben.
That's all right. Thank you.
Got a question from Julie in Melbourne. Hey, Julie.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. What's your question?
Okay, so I know this isn't your area of specialty, but we'll give it a go anyway. So I know that you have to be supposedly be in REM sleep to dream, yet I can dream. I can close my eyes, fall asleep immediately, start dreaming, wake up like what feels like, you know, 30 seconds later, fall back asleep. I can do this three or four times, and I know I'm dreaming, but then I just wake up so easily. And then eventually I go into a proper sleep, and I don't know what happens then, but I seem to be dreaming when I'm not asleep properly.
Ooh, yeah, this happens to me as well. And so I researched it because I thought, well, you're not meant to go straight into REM sleep. And I think sometimes this can happen for some people. So REM sleep is rapid eye movement sleep. And that's a time in your sleep cycle. When you're asleep, your brain is doing a whole lot of different things and it's kind of neatly organized into different times. And when you're in REM sleep, that's when if you look at someone when they're asleep, their eyes will be moving really quickly. Their brain is super active, but their body has kind of shut down there in what's called sleep paralysis. And that's where the majority of our dreams happen. But we can dream in different sleep cycles. There's still, people don't really know why we dream. There's lots of different ideas as to why we dream, different hypotheses as to why it happens. But there could be something else happening for you as well. You could be having a hypnagogic hallucination. So if you're, when you're falling asleep and you're just kind of drifting off and then you kind of feel like you're falling, that's a hypnagogic or a hypnic jerk.
The inception fall is what you're referring to when you're falling backwards.
Yeah. Oh, it happens to me all the time. I hate it. But there's also this time where you can have really vivid hallucinations just as you're falling asleep, and that's a really common phenomena with a term. So that's hypnagogic or hypnagogic hallucinations. And I listened to a fantastic episode of a podcast called Ologies, which I really like, about sleep, and they were talking about dreams and what can happen when you're dreaming and not dreaming and how dreams can be influenced. And the researchers had done this thing where they had people falling asleep and dreaming, and then they were playing different kind of sounds and things to see if those sounds entered their dreams. And the researchers concluded, well, sounds that are playing around you while you're asleep can't influence your dreams. But when I wake up in the morning, I put the radio on and then I often go back to sleep and I often dream about things that happened in the radio. And especially because I work in radio, I'm often dreaming about, like, I can see my colleagues saying these things. So I know I'm not at work, but I can see, say, the morning's presenter here, Rick Goddard, talking. And then I will wake up and that's actually what he was saying. So there's an element of confabulation. My brain is creating this image of the fabulous Rick Goddard talking. But then also I know that something happened with a ferry. I know that that happened. And I've been thinking, I thought that was happening during REM sleep when I was fully asleep and dreaming, but maybe it was happening in that really early state just as I kind of woke up and then was falling back to sleep. So maybe it's hypnagogia.
I have had the radio dream where nothing works on the panel and stuff. And I do have, I have similar to Julie. I wake up and then I go back to sleep and I have very vivid dreams. Thanks so much for your question, Julie.
Oh,
I hope
cool.
you are,
thank you so much.
Are doing a dream journal with all these, because it sounds insane to have a back-to-back-to-back dream feature.
Yeah, great. All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Julie. Another question here from Scott in Campbelltown. Hey, Scott.
G'day, doctors. How are you?
Very good. What's your question?
I've been growing a beard for about five and a half years, which is 50-50 of grey and brown-coloured hair. Now, I'm finding that I lose more grey hair than my normal hair colour of brown. Is grey weaker than normal coloured hair?
Oh, that's a good question. So grey hair is really different to non-grey hair in lots of different ways. So the genes that are being expressed. So we've got our genetic code, and that's the code that tells us who we are. You know, we've got the same genes in the cells making our hair as the cells in our liver, as the cells in our hearts and the cells in our toes. It's all the same genes, but which genes are being used is different. And the genes that are active in grey hair production are different to the genes that are active in your kind of regular brown or red or black blonde hair production. And grey hair grows a little bit faster. So I'm getting to the point that I don't actually know, but I'm sure that someone would know this. And I do know that grey hair can grow faster. So potentially if it's growing faster, hair has a kind of life cycle. It, you know, it grows, and then it has this time where, you know, the what's producing the hair stops working. And that's when your hair will fall out. And some people can grow hair down, you know, right down to the ground, whereas other people can never get, you know, they really want long hair, but they can't get past shoulder length. And that's maybe because their hair kind of has a faster life cycle. So maybe the life cycle of a grey hair is harder and faster and kind of like living large compared to a brown hair. Not sure though.
Yeah. Okay. Because I've tried different things where I've gone a week without washing it and a week with washing it, and I find the same thing, that it's to say grey. I seem to lose more grey regardless of what I do. But yeah, interesting.
Yeah, and grey hair's often thicker. I'm not sure if your grey hairs are thicker than the other hairs in your beard, and so maybe you're noticing them more as well. But yeah, it might be the life cycle of those hairs is just different to the brown hairs. There might not be much you can do, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Love it, Scott. Love the amateur science, beard science going on there. We're talking a lot about echidnas. Always seen a lot of echidnas. And we got a great text in from Blake in Meanjin, Brisbane, who said, shout out to a citizen science app called Echidna CS. It was set up by a couple of echidna researchers looking at the populations of echidnas around Australia. So, Zoe, I believe you brought up Echidna CS. What are we looking at?
Well, it's Echidna CSI. So,
CSI.
The Conservation Science Initiative. But essentially, our incredible mammals can be very hard to track and understand where they are and how they're doing and how different things are affecting them. And so there's all these citizen science projects where people are asked to feed in data to essentially figure out where these animals are. And Echidna CSI is a place where you can find not just echidnas, but specifically echidna poo. And if you are on a bushwalk and you find an echidna poo, they want you to let them know about it. Yep. And so it goes into the Atlas of Living Australia, which is this incredible resource that has just all this data about wildlife throughout Australia, whole lots of different species. There's lots of different ways people can contribute to the Atlas of Living Australia. But one way is looking out for echidna poo. And echidna poo is kind of like a sausage with bits of ant in it, essentially. They're in Tassie, they're pretty much eating ants on the mainland. They're eating ants and termites and grubs and things. And so if you see a sausage that's got a whole lot of little bits of bug in it, that's an echidna poo. Chuck it on Echidna CSI.
Echidna crime scene investigation. We have Yana from Mackay on the line. Hey, Yana.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question today?
I guess I've always just wondered what determines how big someone's feet get.
Ooh, big feet, big feet. Once I was introduced on radio as someone who had really big feet, because someone had looked at show notes and talked about how I was filling Dr. Carl's shoes, and they assumed I had the same shoe size as Dr. Carl.
For the record, what is your shoe size?
I don't know, like 8.5, 9, and his would be way larger. And I had to explain that, no, it was his metaphorical shoes, not his actual shoes. But yeah, back to what makes your feet big or small, mainly genetics. So you're getting that from your parents' foot size genes. You might have the same shaped feet as one of your parents as well. But then other things go into it. So how much food you're eating, and then when you're a teenager, the type of kind of hormonal spurts you're having and when you're having them, that can impact foot growth as well. And then as you age, your feet change. So the different types of activity you're doing might change the size of your feet. When people are pregnant, their feet will often get larger, and as they age, their feet might spread out, that type of thing. So it's mainly genetics, but also if you're not eating a lot of nutrients, you won't get big feet.
There you go, Yana. Hope that answered your question. Jana, how big are your feet for the record?
Yeah, I asked this because I guess I have always been told I have really big feet and big hands for my height. So I have size 9 feet, which is quite big for a lot of people around my height.
Yeah, I'm the same. I have quite large hands. My friends often Photoshop. My wrists are quite small. My hands are quite big. They Photoshop me to look like an alien, which is very fun of them. Thanks so much for your question, Jana.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We've got Amelia in Marrickville with a question. Hey, Amelia.
Hey, guys. My question is, why do birds not get tired when on migration? Do they fly the whole time? Do they take breaks? I know nothing about it, and I've always been curious.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a great question. They can actually take little micro sleeps, so they would get pretty tired. Some birds fly all the way, say, from Siberia, you know, down to southern Victoria or to Tasmania, and some of these birds weigh as much as a piece of toast. So they're going an incredibly long way, just weighing as much as a piece of toast. So they can do things like have a little micro sleep. And there's lots of interesting research in micro sleeps in birds because we do need to sleep. But the other thing they'll do is stop and rest and feed along the way. And there's a lot of kind of connectivity between those places. It's called, they'll have, their migration routes are called flyways. And we've got one in Australia, the Australasian flyway. And there's communities that live all along the flyways that do things to protect the habitats where they land. So they're often landing in places like wetlands. A lot of migratory birds love wetlands. And so those places need to stay really healthy because you can imagine you're like, oh, we've got lots of wetlands in Australia. But if we develop along a piece of coast where they would usually stop and have their little break and their rest up and their feed up, then even though there's lots of habitat on the north and the south of that side, they might not be able to survive because they can't have their little rest and their little snacky. So there's a whole lot of work to try and protect these sites. They're called Ramsar sites.
Birds are just like me. I need a little rest and a little snacky on a long road trip.
Yeah, and there's an incredible Australian person who has flown around in a microlite plane, microlite Millie. I can't remember her last name, but there's a kid's book that this is my mum wrote. My mum wrote the kid's book called A Shorebird Flying Adventure, and it's about microlite Millie going around Australia and advocating for these migratory birds and all the communities from Siberia all through Southeast Asia and then Australia that are connected by the flyway. And yeah, they do all these events and storytelling events along the flyway. So check it out.
Thanks so much for your question, Amelia.
Thank you.
And we got a question from Jazz in Eora, Sydney about leeches. Hey, Jazz.
Hi, doctors. I was just wondering, I read somewhere recently that a leech has 32 brains. I was just wondering, is this true and why do they have so many?
Yes, it's kind of true. So leeches have a decentralized nervous system. So we have a central nervous system and we're cephalized. We've got a head and then a central nervous system that kind of comes out from this control center at the top. But leeches have these kind of like mini brains, ganglion segment things. So they're not quite a brain. But the great thing about having a decentralized nervous system is that if you have incredible damage to a part of your body, and you can imagine if you're a leech, maybe a bird comes, picks you up, decides you're gross and drops you down, and you've got this big peck out of you, you're way more resilient if you've got a non-centralized nervous system. So it's like maybe if you were creating a data sharing system, if you had all of like the information in one big hard drive, well, if that hard drive goes, if there's a fire in that building, nothing. But if it's all on a whole lot of different computers, then you can share it. So that's kind of what's going on with the leech.
So you're saying that the leech is diversifying its portfolio to keep its one thought stored in 32 places.
Exactly. And it's got two thoughts. It's got blood and sex. And when I started my zoology degree, you kind of start with you start with jellyfish and sponges, and then you go through all these different animals that are worm-shaped. And all of these worm-shaped things like leeches and worms, they've just got their body is absolutely stuffed with egg-making and sperm-making apparatus, and that's pretty much all they are. They're just a giant egg and sperm making thing that drinks your blood, but has 32 brains, so can hold two thoughts.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, that's so funny. I love how different animals, like, there's not necessarily a relationship between the amount of brains they have or how big the brain is and how smart they are, which is quite funny. Okay, so we have one more final rapid fire question from Hayden and Yamba. Hayden, rapid fire question. What do you have?
G'day. So I do a lot of crab fishing in Yamba, and I've just noticed that when the water gets really warm, the crabs seem to have soft shells and they're just molted. And in the winter, colder months, they never really molt. So I'm just wondering, what is it about hot water that makes mud crabs molt their shells?
Oh, I've no idea for that species of crab. So I can have a punt at where you'd start asking. And essentially, crabs, like snakes, like lizards, they don't create their own warmth, body warmth, like we do. And so they rely on energy from the environment and the warmth of the environment around them to do their processes. And so maybe they just need to have that warm water, and this is absolutely a guess, but maybe they just need to have that warm water to fire their processes, to get their metabolism going, like how a snake needs to spend time hanging out on a rock in the sun. So maybe that's it. Maybe that's just the time of year. It's the trigger to do it, but that would be my guess.
Animals are very particular. They need very particular environments, temperatures, locales to, you know, get their processes going. Hayden, I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, thanks for that.
Good luck with the crab fishing. I think that's about all we have time for today. Thanks so much, Zoe, for coming on. So the people do want to know about your book just before you go. A little bit more about that if they want to go read it and where they can find you.
Yeah, it's called Why Are We Like This? And you can find it on audiobook, or you can find it as a physical book, an ebook, any type of book where books are sold or in libraries. And you can find me on social media. So on most social medias, I'm Zoe, Zoe. _Keen, Kean, _Sci. So the start of science. So Zoe Keen Sci.
I heard that the audiobook recording process was a bit crazy. Is that true?
Oh, it was so grueling. I did my book and I'd never done it before. And then I did two of Carl's books. So Carl's got all these women involved in STEM to narrate his audiobooks. And so I did those all in one kind of big 2-week setting. And by the end, I got something that's like so obviously named in the early 2000s, late 90s. It's called cyber sickness. And it's essentially when you get it's like being motion sick, but it's from looking at a screen for too long and just scrolling. So I just got sick from scrolling. So that's ever happened to you? Cyber sickness.
I mean, it could. Who knows? I feel like I'm at risk, at high risk. Thanks so much, Zoe. Thanks so much for listening to this week's edition of Science with Dr. Carl. Regular programming with Lucy and Carl back next week. Thanks so much to Josh Brennan and Ali Sadek for producing this episode. Catch you next week. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack podcast, it's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.